Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. 17 years ago, Onaje Woodbine was living the dream. He grew up poor in Boston, honed his basketball talents on the hard courts of Roxbury, and ended up playing for Yale, where he was the lead scorer and among the best in the Ivy League. Then, during his sophomore year, he quit because he wanted more. He wanted a life of the mind, to keep out of a system that valued young black men as profitable athletic workers. That led him back to the basketball courts in Roxbury, to a doctorate of philosophy at BU, and to Phillips Academy in Andover, where he teaches philosophy and religious studies. Last May, Onaje Woodbine published a book about the power of basketball and his journey called Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip-Hop, and Street Basketball. So let's listen back to that interview. Woodbine talked first about the role that basketball played in his life when he was a young man.
When I was 12 years old, I lost my coach and mentor who was like a father to me. Early on, I didn't have a father in my life. Later on, we reconnected. But during those early years, I really, you know, needed a male role model in my life. And he was really the person who stood out for me. And he passed away. Mm. He was in a car accident. He was a police officer, Boston police officer, and he lost his life that day. And, you know, I went to the basketball court to sort of find him. You know, I remember the next day going to the court and shooting around and you know, I was asking myself, what happens when you die? You know, where do you go? Where is Manny? And, you know, the court was the place where I felt most comfortable asking those kinds of questions.
Hmm. Now, why is that? What did the court offer you at that time?
Well, you know, in the streets, as a young black man, you have to have wear a certain mask. You know, you have to look tough. You have to walk with a certain style that is really, you know, you get a false sense of self living in the streets because you have to protect yourself from the violence. And so the court represented a place of safety. It represented a place where I could question, where I felt like I was a human being, where I felt love, you know, from my peers. So I think it was just a natural place for me to share those emotions of pain and grief and to ask those kinds of, you know, deep human questions.
And in your case, at that point in your life, it was also a place where you could express a certain amount of athletic talent and identity, right?
Well, definitely. You know, growing up in the inner city, there are three sort of identity options for young black men. There are others, but, you know, the main ones are either you're a ball player, a rapper, or a gang member. And, you know, I was blessed to be able to have the talent to play ball because the gang members would leave you alone. They'd give you a pass. They, you know, they'd say, you know, this young man, he represents the hope of this community. And so we don't want him to participate in the violence. So to have that talent and that identity, it meant everything. It meant the difference between life and death for me.
Yeah. So you end up making this remarkable journey from the hard courts of Roxbury to Yale University. And what's striking about what you write about that experience is you were a star. You were successful, as we said in the introduction, by many measures, you were living the dream. But you encountered some dramatic disappointment there.
Definitely. You know, I reconnected with my father when I was 15 years old, and he taught me that I already had everything I needed within me, that all I had to do was listen to that still small voice. And I carried that with me on the court. The basketball game became a moving meditation for me, and I carried that to Yale. And it was shocking to me that coaches and, you know, athletic administrators didn't value that they didn't encourage that or seek to cultivate or foster that kind of self-exploration amongst athletes. You know, we were treated like laborers and, you know, we were there to work and, you know, it was like a job. And at Yale, you know, the reason why I went to Yale was because I thought they would foster the life of the mind and the body. And I discovered that, you know, the body was emphasized over the mind.
You wrote something that really, really struck me about this particular topic. I'm just going to read it. Even though my inner city coaches were often less educated, they saw hoops as an extension of our lives in which players' deepest thought and everyday struggles played a significant role. How ironic it was then to discover that one of the greatest institutions of learning in the world, coaches built a tacit but impenetrable wall between athletics and the life of the mind.
It's
so beautifully expressed and so sad and disappointing.
It really was. I mean, the word coach was sacred, you know, where I came from. That was the person who told you, you know, if you don't do your homework, if you don't read, you know, your papers, you can't get on this court. You know, you know, this game is meant to elevate your mind and your spirit. And so to find that, you know, at Yale, you know, we practice for 4 hours a day, that, you know, we never discussed issues of dealing with either society or the life of the mind or character. It came as a huge shock to me, and particularly when I discovered a lot of misogyny and racism in the locker room. You know, racial division as well. Many, you know, the white players, most of them, especially my first year, were in a fraternity which none of the black players belonged, and there was silence on racial issues. And it was quite depressing to realize that the game that I had loved and given all of my heart to had become a corporation.
Mm. And it's quite striking, too, the way you describe sort of the role of talented black males within this corporation, that they're sort of seen as essentially black athletic workers.
Well, certainly that's the myth of slavery, you know, that sort of black men are extremely sound in body, right, that they have this almost primitive athletic ability, but that it comes along with a defective mind. And, you know, I think that racial myth, it does push these young men to the court. Poverty does push, you know, young African-American men to the court as well. But, you know, my thesis is that once they arrive there, there's agency, right? Mm-hmm. They're moving their bodies with each other, and they're gaining access to a mode of release from the culture. So it's this paradox.
Yeah. So you decided to quit, and I gather this was probably shocking to your coaches. And there's quite an amazing story about the reaction of one of your coaches, right?
Definitely. One of my coaches, who was a white assistant coach, somebody who I had thought, you know, had my best interests in mind the entire year, you know, once I decided to exercise my own freedom and agency, he wrote me a pretty nasty letter claiming that I had been admitted to Yale simply on the basis of my athletic ability and that I owed the university something. And, you know, what really shocked me is that he made the claim that Yale only admitted black players, black students, if they were athletes.
Yeah. And there was a suggestion that you'll be sort of letting down the prospects of future black students if you quit.
Well, right. You know, he tried to sort of hoist the burden of my race, you know, on my shoulders, as if, you know, my leaving the team would hurt the chances of other black students gaining admission to Yale.
Yeah. How did you react to that at the time?
You know, at the time, I was angry, I was saddened, I was shocked. But, you know, again, listening to that inner voice, I eventually forgave him. Mm-hmm. You know, I forgave him because I felt like it was a systemic issue. It was a cultural issue. There's so much pressure on coaches for winning. And, you know, the issues of race and gender and class aren't discussed in these contexts. And so I wrote him a letter just asking him to rethink, you know, his letter. And, you know, and I just wished him well. And to this day, you know, I hope that our conversations and interactions have sort of changed him for the better.
You know, Onaje, there's such an interesting sort of dichotomy at the heart of your story, because the sort of power of the court early in your life begins with this idea that it's almost an expression of personal identity and freedom. And then you travel in a way to the top, at least in terms of college athletics, which is pretty high up, and the court becomes a kind of prison of expectation because you are a black person. So it's anything but an expression of freedom.
Well, yes, you know, that's the double consciousness. You know, on the one hand, you know, African Americans, we see ourselves through the eyes of others and, you know, the dominant culture. And on the other hand, there's something behind the veil. There's freedom. There's agency. You know, good players don't simply play by the rules, right? Mm-hmm. They don't go to the court to be exploited. And part of the problem with social science and a lot of the literature out there on black masculinity in sports is that they view these young men as simply passive participants in the game, right? And it's ironic because they set aside the subjective experience they have on the court. You know, and so what I try to do is say, yes, you know, there is exploitation, but the lived experience, right, that subjectivity, you know, meaning is important for human beings. And these are human beings creating meaning.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about what you went through writing this book. You spent 4 years studying street basketball in Boston. So in a sense, you came back home. You interviewed dozens of young men. What brought you back? I mean, what made you want to write the book?
Yeah, so it was a healing process for me. It really was. I felt survivor's guilt, you know, after leaving Roxbury and entering the Ivy League. In order to do that, I had to leave my community behind in many ways. You know, I was entering a culture which was so different from theirs. And so for me to return, it gave me a sense of wholeness. You know, I was able to see people and to mourn with people and to ask for forgiveness, you know, for people who I left behind. And so
forgiveness for leaving them behind?
Or yeah, you know, because there were funerals that I didn't go to, you know, and there were mothers that I felt like raised me and that I didn't speak to for 5 or 10 years, you know. And so, you know, going back and then going onto the court and seeing some of the guys that I had left behind and being able to rub my body next to theirs and share that love. I mean, it was a journey in my own healing process.
I'd love to hear a story about one of these guys that you came back to, as you say, to rub your body up against theirs on the basketball court. I mean, what did you hear?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the first interviews I had was with a young man named Shorty, and he was a god to me growing up. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that he dribbled the ball, he dribbled over his head. In the NBA would have been a travel, you know, but he had this street ball style that was just uncanny. Mm-hmm. And I just, watching him mesmerized me as a child, and I thought he would go into the NBA, and I hadn't heard about him for years. And so one of these days I went back to Roxbury as I was writing the book, and I saw him on the court, and he still moved with the grace, you know, of a ballerina out there. Mm. And but what was so striking is that when I approached him, he couldn't look me in the eye. And I later found out that he had just been released from prison, and he was there to mourn his grandmother who died while he was in prison with his jump shot.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, I talked to him for hours, and we played together. And, you know, it just taught me so much about how young men are using the game to create meaning.
And if they do that successfully, it can be a truly transcendent sort of experience for them, right?
Certainly, yes. You know, in the streets, you know, your ego is so wrapped up in the violence and the distractions. Part of what ritual does, and the ritual of basketball does, it gives you a moment to place that assumption or that identity in abeyance, right? You can bracket it.
Right.
For a moment in time and look at it and see yourself, you know, and rework some of those things. And so it is a kind of transcendent experience. And, you know, oftentimes at the end of the game, if the ritual is really going well, there'll be this cathartic moment where they just let it all out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are witnesses on the sidelines that see those qualities in them, and it's just an amazing experience.
I'm wondering, though, about the danger, not so much the danger, but that is for people who can really take this game to a high level.
Yes.
Like you.
Yes.
There are few of you, and
yes,
most people playing on the hard courts of Roxbury aren't going to go to that level. Do
yes
they need, I don't know, somehow can you provide a sort of reality check and sort of say, when we're talking about transcendence, we're not necessarily talking about fortunes in the NBA. We're talking about the kind of spiritual
right
transcendence that you just described.
Right, right. Well, yes, you know, this needs to be sort of done, choreographed consciously.
Yeah.
Right? We need to choreograph these rituals. And that's why elders are so important around these spaces. And much of this is done unconsciously, right? Yeah. Somebody gets shot, right? Just like I did when I was younger, right? But, you know, guys that I interviewed, a friend gets shot and killed, they go to the court and they mourn that person, but they don't really realize what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But, you know, if we can get our elders to show up at these spaces and choreograph this consciousness, right, intentionally, right, then I think, you know, we have something.
That was Onaje Woodbine, author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip Hop, and Street Basketball, recorded last May. He teaches philosophy and religious studies at Phillips Academy, Andover. And that's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show was produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Cassandra Sunt and Ashley Bailey. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.